Well, brethren, as I'm sure most all of you, you know, particularly those in the U.S. are aware, in the last couple of months, we've all celebrated a couple of holidays, specifically with the purpose of honoring our parents. You know, it's a tradition that comes, you know, in Judeo-Christian cultures, you know, specifically geared from the fifth commandment. And in May, we had specifically Mother's Day. In June, we have Father's Day. And again, both of these are geared specifically to following the commandment of honoring our fathers and mothers. And we have these specific holidays, you know, for that purpose, you know, to encourage that very behavior. I'm sure many other countries have, you know, similar traditions, just not necessarily at the exact same time. And as I mentioned, you know, these traditions are very much based upon the fifth commandment, which specifically tells us that we need to honor our fathers and mothers. Now, you've probably heard over the years, which is a true statement, the statement that this is the first commandment that comes with a promise. And that's true. It does. It is the first commandment with a promise. But oftentimes, the promise that comes with this commandment is misunderstood. Because oftentimes what you'll hear this said, and this is not only in Church of God circles oftentimes, it's in Bible commentaries and other writings. You'll see lots of other, you know, Protestant and Catholic groups also kind of promote the same idea. It's the idea that the promise associated with this commandment is a promise that as long as you honor your father and mother, God guarantees that you're going to live a long life on this earth. Now, if you think about that, I know I myself can look back at my life and easily come up with a couple of names that I would think challenge that very idea. You know, individuals that I have known personally that, you know, from my experience were very respectful and honoring of their parents, yet they happened to die, you know, very tragically young, either through illnesses or accidents or other things of that nature. You know, and I've also known many other people in my life who would also make the same claim. You know, that they've, you know, personally know one or even multiple individuals who they would, you know, personally attest to the fact very much honored their parents, yet they died very young. So what we're going to do today is look at this particular commandment and that promise to see what this promise is actually saying. Because I think what we're going to discover today is this common idea of what the promise is actually flawed and misunderstands what God was saying when he made this promise. Because again, otherwise we've got a logical problem of how do we reconcile the numerous examples that we can all think of that violate this idea. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's that your days may be long upon the land. Again, quote, that your days may be long upon the land. Now, as we're going to see, this quote is taken directly from Exodus 20, and it speaks to exactly what the promise is. So to start off today, turn over to Exodus chapter 20. As we're going to read actually what this promise is, and notice the wording. Because again, the common ideas we're going to see here as to what this promise is about is actually a misunderstanding of what God was actually saying in the first place. It's Exodus 20 in verse 12. It says, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land which Jehovah your God is giving you. Now notice specifically what the promise was. It's specifically tied to how long you're in the land. It's your days in the land that's being referenced. It doesn't specifically say, well, as long as you honor your father and mother and you're respectful for that, well, you're guaranteed to live a long life. You know, and anybody, you know, who does that will never die young. Tragically, they'll always live a long life. Now, if you're like myself, I mean, this is actually thinking back many years ago, but I remember growing up, you know, in the Church of God because I've been in the church since birth, and, you know, in my younger years, I've particularly even heard it said dogmatically in sermons, you know, that this is a promise that if you honor your father and mother, you're always going to live a long life. And I've even heard the statement made that, you know, well, if somebody, you know, died tragically young, well, you know, they didn't really honor their parents because, you know, if they did, they would have lived a long life. Well, again, I myself, and I'm sure many of you hearing this, could go, no, I specifically know of individuals that I know how respectful they were of their parents, and that's just simply not the case. Well, again, if we just pay attention to the wording here, we can see what the promise is. Again, it's tied directly to their time in the land. Now, I'll explain this statement later. in this sermon. But what we're going to see today is that this is much more a promise tied to what I'm going to call a national security to the nation of Israel than it is an individual promise about, you know, individual longevity. Now, the commandments here are also covered in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And the wording in Deuteronomy chapter 5, you know, particularly how it's worded in the New King James, can suggest, you know, that it is talking about a promise for long life. But if you'll turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 5, we can take a closer look at this. It's Deuteronomy chapter 5. In verse 16. Now I'm reading from the New King James, and you'll see in a moment why I'm specifically specifying that. It says, "Honor your father and mother, as Jehovah your God has commanded you, that your days may be long, and that it may be well with you in the land which Jehovah your God is giving you." Now the way it's worded here, and particularly where, you know, the New King James places the comma, makes it sound like there's basically two different thoughts here. You know, one being, you know, a promise that you're going to, you know, if you honor your parents, you're definitely going to have a long life, and you'll also enjoy your time in the land. You know, in reality, both of these are tied to, you know, to the longevity in the land. Now, let me share with you a different translation here that makes this a little bit more clearly. I'm going to read to you this same verse out of the Complete Jewish Bible. Now, before I do that, let me also explain one other unique thing about the Complete Jewish Bible translation, so you'll understand what I'm reading here. We've covered a number of times in the last few years, you know, kind of the Jewish tradition of how whenever they would see Jehovah, you know, the name of God the Father, you know, written in the Bible, they would often substitute it with Adonai. You know, in fact, this tradition kind of got carried over into most English translations of the Bible. That's why you see the word Lord in all caps, you know, to typically whenever the name of the Father is there. And you see Lord in all caps, and you see Big Lord and Little Lord, you know, and it all kind of sounds the same in English. Well, where this came from is from the Jewish tradition of substituting Adonai, you know, that whenever they saw Jehovah actually written out. And the reason I mention that is I'm going to read the Complete Jewish Bible translation verbatim, and you're going to see Adonai here. But just to read this verse from the Complete Jewish Bible, it says, "Honor your father and mother as Adonai your God ordered you to do, so that you will live long and have things go well with you in the land Adonai your God is giving you." So you can see the way this is worded, it ties a little more clearly together. That we're basically talking about two concepts here. One, enjoying the time that you have in the land and extending the amount of time that you're in the land. Because think of it like this. They got the promised land, you know, as a part of the Mount Sinai covenant. And the deal was, you know, Israel had to faithfully obey God. You know, it was obey the letter of the law to receive physical promises. You know, so as long as they faithfully obeyed God, God's, you know, his part of the agreement was, I'll bless you, life will go well with you, you'll constantly be physically blessed, and they'll be given this wonderful promised land to live in as a result. So basically what this is getting at is if you're, you know, consistently obeying God, two things are going to happen, and you'll see as we go later in this sermon why I'm basically laying these out as separately. One is enjoying your time in the land, you know, and the other is extending your days in the land. You know, because as we're going to see, you can still be in the land, but not having a good time while you're there. You know, I mean, you can still be there, but life's not going too well for you. You know, and as we're going to see, as Israel later got, you know, lost the land, what would typically happen first is, you know, things weren't going so well in the land. They were in the land, but things weren't going well, and they weren't enjoying it. And then, two, what would happen is they eventually lost the land. But to see here, what I want you to see as we go through a number of verses here is this concept of, you know, having your days in the land extended as a result of obedience is a promise that is talked about again and again, and it's not just specific to the fifth commandment. We're going to see later in this sermon why it's specifically, you know, in the Ten Commandments tied to the fifth commandment. But this is a promise that's tied to obedience in general, and this is stated numerous numerous times throughout the book of Deuteronomy. We're going to look at a number of scriptures here. They get a little repetitive because they kind of keep saying the same thing, but I want you to see this trend, how this is stated again and again and again. You know, and when you consider that trend, you kind of see the overall context this is placed in. And it's also interesting that this is in the book of Deuteronomy. You know, historically, you know, the book of Deuteronomy is written just right before Israel is going into the promised land. You know, this is to that second generation. You know, the first generation all dies off in the 40 years in the wilderness, you know, because they wouldn't go into the promised land. And the younger generation that's born in the wandering in the wilderness is who actually enters the land. You know, well Deuteronomy is written more to focus on that second generation before they go into the land. But let's notice here the trend of how this, you know, the same concept just keeps getting mentioned again and again and again throughout the book of Deuteronomy, that if they obey God, you know, they're going to enjoy their time in the land and they're going to extend their days in the land. So to start in Deuteronomy chapter 4 in verse 33. It said, Did any people ever hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire, as you have heard and live? Or did God ever try to go and make for himself a nation from the midst of another nation by the trials, by signs, by wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great terrors according to all that Jehovah your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown that you might know that Jehovah himself is God, and there is none other besides him. Out of heaven he let you hear his voice, that he might instruct you on earth. He showed you his great fire, and you heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose your descendants after them. And he brought you out of Egypt with his presence and with his mighty power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in to give you their land as an inheritance as it is this day. Now notice in particular these next two verses. Therefore know this day and consider it in your heart, that Jehovah himself is God in heaven above and on earth and beneath, and there is no other. You shall therefore keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which Jehovah your God is giving you for all time. Now notice what we're tying here is obedience to God. And what's that going to do? Things are going to go well for you. You're going to be, you'll receive the physical blessings and enjoy life, and you're going to extend your time in the land. Now, as I mentioned, we're going to see a number of scriptures where this same concept just keeps getting repeated again and again and again as we go through the book of Deuteronomy. Now, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 5. Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 31. But as for you, stand here by me, and I will speak to you all the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments, which you shall teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I am giving them to possess. And therefore you shall be careful to do as Jehovah your God has commanded you, and you shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And you shall walk in all your ways which Jehovah your God has commanded you, and that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess. Now, anyways, here we are again with, you know, think to what will go well for you, and you will extend your days in the land. And again, we're going to see this concept again repeated again and again. Now turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 11. Deuteronomy chapter 11, and we'll start in verse 16. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Lest Jehovah's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up heavens so that there be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which Jehovah is giving you. Therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and bind them as a sign on your hand, that they may be frontlets between your eyes. And you shall teach them to your children, speaking of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land which Jehovah swore to your fathers to give them, like the days of the heavens above the earth. Again, we see this same concept repeated. I turn also over to Deuteronomy 25. We'll again see this same concept in a couple more scriptures. It's Deuteronomy 25, and we'll start in verse 13. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land, and that Jehovah your God is giving you. For all who do such things, and all who behave unrighteously, are an abomination to Jehovah your God. And then also notice over in Deuteronomy 32, let's see again this same concept. It's Deuteronomy 32, and we'll start in verse 44. So Moses came with Joshua the son of Nun and spoke all the words of this song to the hearing of the people. And Moses finished speaking all these words to all Israel, and he said to them, "Set your hearts in all the words which I testify among you today, which you shall command your children to be careful to observe all the words of this law. For it is not a futile thing for you, because it is your life. And by this word you shall prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to possess." So you notice again, we see this same concept again and again. And it's not, you know, a unique promise, you know, solely attached to the fifth commandment. It's really a promise generally tied to just obeying God and following his instructions. And again, as we'll see later in this sermon, it's really, you might say, a promise about national security. You know, and then the survival of the nation and they're, you know, prolonging their time in the land, it's really not a promise that, you know, as long as you obey your parents, well, you're guaranteed to live a long life and you'll never die tragically young if you obey your parents. That's simply not what it's saying. You know, and unfortunately, that's one of the ideas that's often promoted with this. And I mean, I've even seen in the past at times where that misunderstanding can literally become a source of disillusionment with God. You know, where this idea was very pushed that, you know, it's a, you know, dogmatic promise that you'll always live long. Well, then someone has a, you know, a child or a, you know, close loved one, someone they really care about, who tragically dies young. You know, and if they've internalized this idea that this is a dogmatic promise, you know, that anyone who honors their parents will live long, well, then in their grief, they're looking at this and going, well, God lied. You know, he promised that as long as, you know, we're obedient and someone honors their parents, they're always going to live a long life. And my loved one, I know they honored their parents, but yet they tragically died young. You know, and this can become a source of disillusionment. You know, well, the key to this is understanding, again, that's not what the promise is saying at all. Well, we've looked at a number of verses here about prolonging your days. We'll also see a number of verses, again, that look at it from the opposite perspective. You know, that if Israel was disobedient and didn't regard God's laws, that they would shorten their time in the land, and then they wouldn't have a good time in the land. You know, so let's look at a couple of these. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 4. It's Deuteronomy chapter 4 in verse 23. "Take heed to yourself, lest you forget the covenant of Jehovah your God, which he made with you, and made yourselves a carved image in the form of anything which Jehovah your God has forbidden you. For Jehovah your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. when you beget children and grandchildren and have grown old in the land and act corruptly and make a carved image in the form of anything and do evil in the sight of Jehovah your God to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that you will soon utterly perish from the land which you cross over the Jordan to possess, and it will not prolong your days in it, but will be utterly destroyed. And Jehovah will scatter you among the peoples, and you will be left in number among few in number among the nations where Jehovah God will drive you. So see, what he's specifically saying is, you know, you consistently disobey, well, two things are going to happen. You know, first, you're not going to be enjoying your time in the land because, you're going to stop getting blessed and things are not going to go well, and you're eventually going to get kicked out of the land and scattered. You know, that's what you're going to see. That's why I refer to this as really a promise that's relevant to national security. In fact, he specifically said, you know, the disobedience would result in being vomited out of the land. Like he even, you know, stated that, you know, the nations that he thrust out of the promised land, you know, that lived there previously to allow the, you know, the Israelites to basically to walk in and to take over a land that was already developed with intact cities, you know, with its infrastructure has already been developed. Well, the reason that they were blessed with all of this, well, he drove out the nations, you know, that were already there, and it was specifically because of how evil they were, of how disobedient they were. But he refers to it as being vomited out of the land. So let's turn over to Leviticus 18. It's Leviticus chapter 18. We'll start in verse 24. Now the chapter leading up to this is really going in, is really talking about the laws of sexual morality, and you can see it covers it from numerous angles, to incest, to bestiality, to, you know, to all manner of perversions, and it even says, you know, the people that you're coming to take this land, they commit all of these atrocities, you know. So I mean, if you read that, you can really see how evil the people there in the land were, you know, when you read through all the different things that are described, and he says these people are guilty of committing all of this. You know, but let's notice what happened to them as a result. And then we can pick up now in verse 24. It says, "Do not defile yourself with any of these things, for by all of these things the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you." In other words, the Canaanites, and the people that they lived there before, they were guilty of all of the sins that are mentioned, you know, prior in this chapter, even including, you know, child molesting and bestiality and just all sorts of perversion. And you pick up in verse 25, "For the land is defiled, therefore I visit this punishment on its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. And you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, either any of you of your own nation or any stranger who sojourns among you. For all these abominations the men of the land have done, and who were before you, and thus the land is defiled, lest the land vomit you out also when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations who were before you. For whoever commits any of these abominations, the perversions, and the persons who commit them will be cut off from among their people. Therefore you shall keep my ordinance, so that you do not commit any of the abominable customs which were committed before you, and you do not do defile yourselves by them. I am Jehovah your God." Now we see a similar comment made over in Leviticus chapter 20. You just turn over to Leviticus chapter 20. In fact, the context of this chapter goes through not just only, you know, sexual sin, but a variety of perversions. Well, one of them even being the, you know, the sacrificing of children to Molech. You know, it's easier for us today to kind of look at that and go, "Oh, how barbaric!" You know, they threw their children in the fire. Well, it's not a whole lot different than our modern day practice of abortion. you know, which, you know, fortunately that's, you know, we've seen some progress in that regard today, you know, recently in the U.S., but there's still plenty of people that, you know, claim that this is somehow a constitutional right to murder your children, you know, so you can see that the society we have today is very much just as evil as the Canaanites. But if you pick up here in verse 22, "And you shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments and perform them, that the land where I am bringing you to dwell may not vomit you out. And you shall not walk in the statutes of the nations which I am casting out before you, for they commit all these things, and therefore I abhor them. But I have said to you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you to possess, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am Jehovah your God, who has separated you from the peoples." So he's mentioning how he's going to bless them with this wonderful land, but he says, you know, if you consistently start disobeying, what's going to happen is you're going to get thrust out of it. You know, essentially the land's going to vomit you out. Now, as I mentioned before, I said, you know, this really isn't the promise attached to the fifth commandment. Really, is not a promise of longevity. That, you know, that a person that, you know, that you know, honors their father and mother is guaranteed to never die young and they'll always live a long life. It is really more a promise about national security. Now, why do I say it's a promise of national security? Well, think about this when you hear that term. You know, when you hear, you know, the comment, well, this is a matter of national security. You know, well, what's, you know, typically being referred to? They're saying this is an issue that can, you know, threaten the security and survival of a nation. You know, this is a matter of, you know, so some evil power may be trying to undermine the nation or attack it, and this is about our security and our survival. Well, for ancient Israel, obedience to God in following his commandments was literally a matter of national security, because they were promised that, you know, if they disobeyed God, you know, and continued to do that for any length of time, that was going to result in their destruction as a nation. That's how it worked. So turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 8 here. We're going to see that he directly warns the Israelites, you know, right before they go into the promised land here, that you know, faithfully obeying God was, again, literally a matter of national security. That if they didn't do that, that was going to be their destruction and they would be destroyed. This is Deuteronomy 8 in verse 11. "Beware that you do not forget Jehovah your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, and who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, and with your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, and that he might test you, that you do good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and might and my hand has gained me this wealth. And you shall remember Jehovah your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that you may establish his covenant that he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget Jehovah your God, and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. And the nations which Jehovah destroys before you, so you shall perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of Jehovah your God." So notice he's directly telling them, this is a matter of national security. You know, if you don't consistently obey, you know, it's going to be your doom. It's going to be your destruction. You know, but notice, as I mentioned before, there were two different concepts, you know, that we kind of noticed throughout this series of scriptures that we're reading. And that was the promise of, it will go well for you in the land, and it will extend your days in the land. In other words, it's enjoying the experience and then having an extended amount of time in the land, and all of this hinged upon obedience. And the reason I mention that is, again, you can be in the land but not having a good time and enjoying it. And as we can see, as we know from history, both the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, over time, were consistently disobedient with God, and they both wound up going into captivity. But the way the process would play out is typically step number one, it would turn out that they weren't enjoying their time in the land. They were still in the land, but life wasn't going so good, you know, and then they get conquered and carried off into captivity. And let's see how you can see the examples of how this played out. Turn first to 2 Kings chapter 17. We can see, because, you know, first it was Israel that went into captivity, and then later Judah. But the account of the northern kingdom of Israel, going into, we can see this in 2 Kings chapter 17. And we'll start here in verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea the son of Elah became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of Jehovah, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. And Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. And in the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Now the king of Assyria went throughout the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. Now, to also kind of understand some of the historical context, you know, oftentimes a tactic that was used at that time, and even today, you know, oftentimes in warfare, when you besiege a city, you'd go up and basically make a perimeter around it, you know, and you cut off the supply lines, basically. Because what they could do in besieging a city is, again, just surround it and cut off the supply lines and then just sit and wait. You know, because you know over time, you know, they're eventually going to run out of supplies, and anything that they can't produce, you know, within the city itself, they're eventually going to run out of, you know, and if you cut off the supply lines, you know, again, all you got to do is wait, and then the people are going to be hurting, you know, because, again, any food, any other, you know, additional supplies that they need, that they've got to get from outside the city, if you cut off those supply lines and they can't get them, you just wait, you know, and give it time, and now you've got your enemy hurting, you know, before you ever have to actually go in and attack. And what we're going to see is this is what happened with both Israel and with Judah. And what that results in is, see, just think about this. If you're besieged and they cut off the supply lines, you're still in the land, but give it some time and things aren't going, it's not going well. You're not enjoying the experience, you know, and then they eventually get, you know, completely taken and taken off into captivity. But just pick up now in verse 6. And in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria. And he placed them in Hala and by harbor the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. For it was the children of Israel had sinned against Jehovah their God, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh and the king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods, and had walked in the statutes of the nations of whom Jehovah had cast out of before the children of Israel and the kings of Israel which they had made. And now, just skip over to verse 18. It says, and therefore Jehovah was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight, and there was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. And also Judah did not keep the commandments of Jehovah their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel which they made. And Jehovah rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, delivered them into the hand of plunderers, until he had cast them from his sight. For he tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. And then Jeroboam drove Israel from following Jehovah, and made them commit a great sin. For the children of Israel walked in the sins of Jeroboam, which he did, and they did not depart from him until Jehovah removed Israel out of his sight. And he had said to all of his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. So notice what happened to them. You know, they established a history of continually disobeying God, you know, and he's patient through all of this, but finally he goes, okay, I've had enough, you know, and then what happens? You know, they wind up not enjoying their experience in the land. You know, they're besieged and life's not going well, and then they're eventually taken into captivity and removed from the land. They're vomited out of the land. You know, it's really an issue of national security. Well, you know, this happened first to the northern kingdom of Israel, but later the same similar type of thing played out with Judah as well. And that's recorded in Jeremiah 52. Turn over to Jeremiah 52. And we'll start reading this in verse 1. So Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king and reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Hamutal, and the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. And he also did evil in the sight of Jehovah, according to all Jehoiakim had done. For because of the anger of Jehovah, this happened to Jerusalem and Judah, till he finally cast them out from his presence. Then Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Now it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, that in the tenth month, and on the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and encamped against it, and they built a siege against it all around. And again, this, you know, they basically make a perimeter around it, cut off the supply lines. So the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. And by the fourth month, on the ninth day of the month, the famine had become so severe in the city that there was no food for people from the land. Because again, just think about it. If you depend upon supply lines of food, you know, coming from outside this, you know, the city, and you make a perimeter and just cut it off, you just wait, and what's going to happen? The people are going to be starving. Then picking up in verse 7. Then the city was broken through, and all the men of war fled, and went out of the city at night by the wall in the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden, even though the Chaldeans were near the city all around. And they went by way of the plain. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, and they overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from them. So they took the king and brought them up in to the king of Babylon in Reba, and at the land of Hamath, and he pronounced judgment on them. And then the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and he killed all the princes of Judah in Riblah. And he also put out the eyes of Zedekiah out of the and the king of Babylon bound him in bronze fetters, took him to Babylon, and put him in prison till the day of his death. Now in the fifth month, on the tenth day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, who served the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of Jehovah and the king's house, and all that the houses of Jerusalem, that is, all the houses of the great man, he burned with fire. And the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down all the walls of Jerusalem all around. And then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive some of the people, of the rest of the people who remained in the city, and the defectors who had deserted to the king of Babylon and the rest of the craftsmen. But Nebuchadnezzar, the captain, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left some of the poor of the land as vine dressers and farmers. So you can see the majority of the people get carried off into captivity is what happens. And you can see it's a very ugly process of how all this played out. So you can see why I would refer to this as a matter of national security. Because their refusal to obey God eventually resulted basically in the destruction of the nation. You know, they first wind up not enjoying their time in the land, and then they get vomited out of the land. You know, they get carried off into captivity. Now, to give credit to where credit is due, I mean, I have to acknowledge who kind of pointed out this whole concept to me. I have to give credit to my friend Glenn Springfield for basically framing this in the terms of national security. And just to give you a little context with this, Glenn and I became friends about 10 years ago. I used to kind of periodically visit a congregation that he regularly attended, and he kind of befriended me within a few weeks of me coming there. But Glenn used to love to start conversations by saying, "Well, what you been studying this week?" But because he loved to discuss the Bible and to get into conversations about that, and then that kind of resulted in us building a friendship, and it has been now for about 10 years. Well, Glenn still does that, and he comes over to my house for services now. Neither one of us go to the congregation I referred to, but he'll still come in periodically and go, "Well, what you been studying this week?" Well, a few weeks ago he did the same thing, and he mentioned he'd been reading the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20 and saw the promise there. And he looked at me and he goes, that's really just about a promise of national security. And I never had thought about it in those terms. Years ago I noticed that, the idea that it was a promise of everyone having a long life was obviously not the case, because I just knew too many people that, that violated that idea. And I noticed it talking about the land, but I'd never thought of, phrasing it as national security. But as Glenn mentioned this, my eyes kind of popped open and I started racing, because it all started connecting for me. And Glenn even looked at me and he goes, "You're already writing a sermon in the back of your mind, aren't you?" And I kind of laughed and I said, "Yeah." And then I stopped, like, "Well, he speaks too, so I don't want to steal his thunder." So I immediately said to him, I said, "But if you want to take the idea and run with it, I don't want to step on your toes." And he said, "No, if you want to do it, go with it." I said, "Okay, well, great, I will." So I just have to give him credit for allowing me to steal his idea here. But, as I mentioned, that this is a promise more of national security, than it is of longevity. But now let's ask the question, why is it specifically tied to the fifth commandment? Because as we can see, that the general principle of obeying God's commandments as a whole is tied to these concepts, living a long time in the land, enjoying your time in the land. Well, that's tied generally just to the concept of obeying God. But why, when he listed out the Ten Commandments, did God specifically tie this concept to the fifth commandment? Well, to understand that, we have to understand the relationship of what the family structure does to a nation in general over time. Because, not only, it's not just about learning to honor your father and mother. Typically as children, how we learned, that discipline in our lives, not just to respect our parents, but to be good citizens, to respect our fellow man, to respect authority in general, that typically all gets tied to, again, being taught as a young child how to learn to respect authority and how to behave. And if we don't do that, what you'll typically find is people that never learn that basic respect, when they're young, grow up to be delinquents, grow up to be criminals, because they don't respect authority in general. They don't respect law enforcement, they don't respect government, they don't respect their fellow man. Now to see this, turn over to Proverbs chapter 30. It's Proverbs chapter 30. And we'll start reading in verse 11. It says, "There is a generation that curses its father and does not bless its mother." Now let's notice what else it ties with this. Let's just keep reading. "There is a generation that is pure in its own eyes, yet it is not washed from its filthiness. There is a generation, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. There is a generation whose teeth are like swords, and whose fangs are like knives, to devour the poor off of the earth, and the needy from among men." Notice it's tying here with the concept of, not honoring your parents, to basically becoming predators and criminals, that prey upon the innocent, who prey upon the poor and the needy. Because again, there is a direct correlation of, again, the family structure of, again, not just honoring your parents, but again, all that tends to come with that. you know, that if you have an intact family structure and learn to respect, you know, not only your parents, but respect authority, respect your fellow man, of how to conduct yourself, you know, as a human and as a good citizen. If you don't learn that as a child, that typically has long-lasting effects. And as we're going to see a little later in this sermon, you know, the destruction of the family structure has a very direct correlation with crime and all manner of other social problems that comes as a result of it. I mean, you tear apart the family structure, you destroy a society and culture. I mean, this can destroy nations, you know, just from the natural effect that it comes from this. And the key to realizing this, to turn over to Proverbs 22, we'll see here just again that the long-lasting effect that, you know, our childhood can have upon an individual. It's Proverbs 22 in verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. You know, well, for this to be true, the opposite must also be true. You know, if you train up a child well and teach them well, you know, when they're young, then that will affect them the rest of their lives, and they'll be better citizens and better people, and, you know, just have better behavior. Well, if you train them up in the wrong way, you know, and don't show them discipline, don't show them love, and you know, and they're not shown how to respect anybody else, that's going to stay with them the rest of their lives as well. You know, and this can have absolutely multi-generational effects. Again, this can affect an entire culture and society over time. And to see that, turn over to Exodus 34. Exodus 34. Now the context here is basically after the golden calf event, you know, when Moses, you know, basically comes down with the Ten Commandments, you know, tablets, and then, you know, breaks them and everything because of what he's seeing Israel doing, and then he goes back up and, you know, get some new ones, you know, because he broke the first ones, and this is the context here is kind of right after this. But it's in verse 5. It says, then Jehovah descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of Jehovah. And Jehovah passed before him and proclaimed, Jehovah, Jehovah God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Now notice the multi-generational effect that we're talking about here. Now, again, you can read in Ezekiel 18, which we won't take the time to look at here, you know, that God is very clear that we all, you know, we pay for our own sins, that we all have personal accountability, you know, and it's not a matter of, you know, the children get blamed always, you know, for the, you know, the father's sins or vice versa. You know, but the concept here is, again, you raising up a child in the way that they should go. Again, if you do that wrong, what happens? You get a multi-generational effect oftentimes. You know, that you know, if someone is raised up to they don't know how to respect or how to, you know, their fellow citizens or how to conduct themselves and have a proper family or, you know, of relationships, what happens? They'll typically raise their children the same way. You know, and this can go down multiple generations, you know, and infect an entire society if this just keeps going on from generation to generation. And like I said, and if you look at the greater effects of how this can affect an entire society, you can see why he would specifically attach this whole concept to the fifth commandment. You know, that if you don't learn to honor your father and mother, you know, you're going to wind up shortening your days in the land and not enjoying your time because it's going to erode your whole society. You know, they're not going to be consistently obeying, and they're going to wind up getting thrown out of the land is what's going to happen. You know, but it's that powerful effect that has, and again, the multi-generational effect that this can take place. And just to illustrate this, I'd like to share, you know, some excerpts from a couple of articles that address this very concept. Now, I pulled both of these from a similar website. They're both from the website of the Heritage Foundation, which you can find at heritage.org. Now, if you're not familiar with the Heritage Foundation, it's kind of a conservative-oriented think tank, you might say, you know, that addresses, you know, social policy issues and things of that nature. I'm just going to read to you again some excerpts from a couple of articles. These are not the entire articles. Now, this first one's a little older article, but I think you'll see as I read this, the content is still very valid. This is again from the Heritage Foundation website. It was posted March 17th, you know, 1995 is when it was written. It's an article by Patrick Fagan, and the title is "The Real Root Cause of Violent Crime: The Breakdown of Marriage, Family, and Community." Says, quote, "Policymakers at last are coming to recognize the connection between the breakdown of American families and various social problems. The unfolding debate over welfare reform, for instance, has been shaped by the wide acceptance in recent years that children born into single-parent families are much more likely than children of intact families to fall into poverty and welfare dependence themselves in later years. These children, in fact, face a daunting array of problems. While this link between illegitimacy and chronic welfare dependency now is better understood, policymakers also need to appreciate another strong and disturbing pattern evident in scholarly studies. The link between illegitimacy and violent crime, and between the lack of parental attachment and violent crime. Without an understanding of the root causes of criminal behavior, how criminals are formed, members of Congress and state legislators cannot understand why whole sectors of society, particularly in urban areas, are becoming torn apart by crime. And without that knowledge, sound policymaking is impossible. A review of empirical evidence in the professional literature of the social scientists gives policymakers an insight into the root cause of crime. Consider, for instance, over the past 30 years, the rise in violent crime parallels the rise in families abandoned by fathers. High crime neighborhoods are characterized by high concentrations of families abandoned by fathers. State-by-state analysis by Heritage scholars indicates that a 10% increase in the percentage of children living in single-parent homes leads typically to a 17% increase in juvenile crime. The rate of violent teenage crime corresponds with the number of families abandoned by fathers. The type of aggression and hostility demonstrated by a future criminal often is foreshadowed in unusual aggressiveness as early as age 5 or 6. The future criminal tends to be an individual rejected by other children as early as the first grade, who goes on to form his own group of friends, often future delinquent gang. On the other hand, neighborhoods with a high degree of religious practice are not high crime neighborhoods. Even in high crime inner city neighborhoods, well over 90% of children from safe, stable homes do not become delinquents. By contrast, only 10% of children from unstable homes in these neighborhoods avoid crime. Criminals capable of sustaining marriage gradually move away from a life of crime after they get married. The mother's strong affectionate attachment to her child is the child's best buffer against a life of crime. A father's authority and involvement in raising his children are also a great buffer against a life of crime. There's also another article I'd like to share a good section of from you. This one addresses specifically the issue that we oftentimes see in the news these days, and that's the issue of mass shootings. You know, you oftentimes see, you know, see active shooters, you know, going into schools or other areas, you know, particularly when it's children, just shooting up and violently acting out. And oftentimes what you'll see in these cases, you know, is calls later of, oh, we got to ban all the guns. You know, we got the guns are the problem. We just got to get all the guns out of society. You know, when I look back to my childhood, I see how ridiculous that very idea is. You know, the reason I say that, I grew up in a rural farming community in southern Alabama, you know, where deer hunting was something most everybody did. You know, if you went, you know, to most houses, there was probably a gun in most every house. I mean, there was multiple guns in the house I grew up in. It was also a neighborhood where you could pretty much leave your doors unlocked and not have to worry about crime. I mean, it was not unusual in my high school, oftentimes, to look out into the parking lot and see the pickup trucks there were, you know, they were parked out there, and see shotguns and rifles hanging in the gun racks, you know, out from school. Now, don't get me wrong, if someone had taken, you know, a gun out and carried it in school, waved it around, that would have caused a big problem. You know, people would have been upset about that. You know, but the concern would have been more that someone was going to accidentally, carelessly shoot somebody, you know, than it was that they were going to come in with ammo and try to shoot everybody in sight. You know, that just really wasn't a big concern. You know, today, the very existence of seeing a gun in a gun rack at a school would have everybody panicking. You know, but again, even though there were guns all over the place, there wasn't a murder rate in this town. Nobody was shooting anybody. And that's because it was a conservative community, you know, of, you know, mostly professing Christians. You know, again, they weren't Church of God, but, you know, various, you know, forms of Protestantism typically. But there was the fundamental Judeo-Christian values that people believed in, and there just wasn't a murder rate. You know, and again, let me share with you an article that kind of addresses this and shows the strong correlation, you know, but again, between these, you know, active shooters and basically the breakdown of the family structure, you know, the very breakdown of Judeo-Christian values. Again, this article also comes from the Heritage Foundation website. This is from March 14, 2018, and this is authored by Emily Kao. The title of the article is "The Crisis of Fatherless Shooters." Quote, "In the wake of the Parkland massacre, an age-old question, am I my brother's keeper, has a newfound relevance. As another mass school shooting stuns Americans, it is time to talk about not just how to protect students from shooters, but also about what must happen so that fewer students become shooters in the first place. It is crucial to talk about how more American children can grow up with the emotional, psychological, and spiritual security that comes from relationships where one is deeply cared for, connected, and known. For what lies inside so many school shooters is a deep void of identity, relationship that they tragically seek to fill through nihilistic violence. There is a sobering theme repeated over and over in the biographies of school shooters: the fatherlessness of a broken or never formed family. Among the 25 most cited school shooters since Columbine, 75% were reared in broken homes. Psychologist Dr. Peter Langram, a preeminent expert on school shooters, found that the most came from incredibly broken homes, of not just divorce and separation, but also infidelity, substance abuse, criminal behavior, domestic violence, and child abuse. After the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, scholar Brad Wilcox called attention to the work of criminologist Michael Gottfriedson and Travis Hirashi, which found the absence of fathers to be one of the most powerful predictors of crimes. He explains that fathers are role models for their sons who maintain authority and discipline, and therefore helping them develop self-control and empathy towards others, key character traits lacking in violent youth. The late rapper Tupac Shakur said, "I know for a fact that if I had a father, I would have had some discipline. I'd have had more confidence. Your mother can't calm you down the way a man can. You need a man to teach you how to be a man." Shakur also was also murdered in 1996. He started hanging out with gangs because he wanted to belong to a family. In addition to structure and discipline, a boy's relationship with his father can be a profound source of identity, or not. Dr. Warren Farrell, author of The Boy Crisis, says that when a boy asks, "Who am I?" the answer is that his identity is comprised of half his dad and half his mom. Boys who do not have a strong relationship with their fathers may lack a model of healthy masculinity. many of the school shooters struggled with a sense of damaged masculinity and sought to become ultra-masculine. Langman says that at the end of this spectrum is getting a gun to suddenly have power. In fact, the fathers of three of the most infamous school shooters were absent from their sons' lives. The father of Adam Lanza, the Sandy Hook shooter, had not seen his son in 2 years and later told reporters he wished his son had never been born. The adoptive father of Nicholas Cruz died when Cruz was 5 years old. And the father of 6-year-old Diedrich Owens, the country's youngest school shooter, was in jail when his son killed his first grade classmate. Diedrich Owens' father has said that he suspects his son's crime was a reaction to his absence. Since the 1965 Monahan Report, the breakdown of the American family has been hotly debated. Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Monaghan's findings that fatherlessness would lead to poorer outcomes for African-American children was published at a time when only 25% of African-American households were led by a single parent. Today, 24% of white non-Hispanic families are headed by a single parent, and the rate has reached 66% among African Americans. If we don't reverse current trends on marriage, the number of fatherlessness children will only grow. As you can see here, having an intact family, and again, all that that produces in rearing a child, again, to not only respect their parents, to respect society, to know how to function and have a, you know, an intact family themselves and pass that on from generations, is enormous. You know, and again, the correlation between the breakdown of the family and the breakdown of society, of crime and all manner of social problems, you know, is a huge correlation. And when you take that into consideration, you can then see why, you know, you would tie directly, you know, honoring your father and mother to the national security of Israel. I have to say, if you don't get this right, if you don't have the family structure and proper roles here in place, it's eventually going to destroy your society is what's going to happen. You know, because you're going to wind up with delinquent children and, again, generational problems, visiting the sins of the fathers on the third and fourth generation. And this is going to grow and it's eventually going to destroy your society and you're going to get thrown out of the land. That's what the promise of the fifth commandment is talking about. So see, if we look at this, we can understand it's not a promise that just because, you know, if someone obeys their parents and is faithful and being respectful, that they're guaranteed to have a long life and they won't die tragically young. That is simply not what God was saying at all. You know, that's a complete misunderstanding of what the promise of the commandment is. What it's telling us is how important the family structure is, of how important it is that we not only honor our father and mother, but that we teach each generation to do the same, and that we retain these Judeo-Christian values in our life and how we live, because it is important to the national security of a nation, you know, and it's for our survival as a nation today. So, brethren, as we look at this, we can now appreciate the traditions we have in our country of Mother's Day and Father's Day and, you know, honoring our parents, and realize that what God is telling us with this, he's not just telling us how to have a more productive family relationship. He's telling you how to preserve the national security of an entire society.